Hi, I'm Susan Swain, host of C-SPAN's Q&A, where we spend an hour with nonfiction writers and historians who add context to today's news.
For our President's Day episode, journalist Alex Prudhomme, author of the new book, Dinner with the President, tells us how presidents since George Washington have used food to advance their policy and diplomatic goals. Throughout history, presidents have organized private, small group dinners with members of Congress and other strategic partners, personal visits to a president's second home, and grand state dinners at the White House to get intelligence, win support for their policies, and build alliances at home and abroad.
Our conversation will begin in just a moment.
Alex Prudhomme, the nation is marking President's Day, and you have a new book that has a different take on presidential history. Tell me about it.
It's called Dinner with the President, Food, Politics, and a History of Breaking Bread at the White House. And it is a survey of 26 of our 46 presidents, the foods they ate, their food policies, the importance of food to the nation in many ways. And it's really, at its core, a story about the politics of food and the food of politics, viewed through the lens of the White House, which is sort of a unique place.
What inspired this?
Well, I grew up in a household of foodies who like to talk politics around the dinner table. And so it was a kind of a combination of things. I wrote a Julia Child's memoir, My Life in France, and some subsequent books about Julia. And in my research, I discovered that Julia had attended the White House on numerous occasions and televised two state dinners there. The first was in 1967 with LBJ, and the second was in 1976 when Gerald Ford hosted Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip for the bicentennial. And so that notion intrigued me. The idea that she had was to show the people a side of the people's house that they had never seen before. Her cameras were the first ones ever to go into the White House kitchen and observe the incredible effort it takes to prepare for a state dinner and to pull it off. And then in 2016, I was giving a little talk at the White House for mid-level staffers at the Obama administration about fresh water and why I think it's going to be the defining resource of this century, based on my book, The Ripple Effect. And a friend of mine worked at the Obama administration and offered to take me to lunch in the Navy mess, which is a cafeteria on the ground floor, and then gave me a quick private tour of the White House, which I had never seen up close and personal before. And to my surprise, I was emotionally impacted by that tour. I mean, you know, the White House looms large in our minds as a symbol, but it is also an actual functioning home, the nerve center of the United States, a decorative arts museum, and probably the most influential home in the world. So all these ideas were swirling around in the back of my mind. And without really realizing it, the idea kind of coalesced, that my interest in food and politics kind of came together in that moment. I was in the middle of other things. 2 years later, I returned, and in 2018, I began to work on this book, which is now coming out. It's called Dinner with the President.
Readers, I think, will pretty quickly pick up that you had a lot of fun working on this project. Where are some of the places your research took you?
Well, this was such a fun book to do because I'm a history nerd and a foodie, and it was just sort of a combination of all these things. COVID intervened halfway through, but I was able to go to places like Hyde Park, Monticello, Mount Vernon, the Woodrow Wilson House in Washington, and see these places, and of course the White House. And they really bring history alive. You see where these people lived. I mean, seeing FDR's kitchen, which is enormous and well-appointed, compared to Woodrow Wilson's kitchen, which is kind of dark and slightly odd looking to my eye. And they had very different ideas about food, and it's sort of physically represented there. Or you go to Monticello and you see the fantastic gardens that are still functioning in this wonderful, weird house, with sort of like going inside of his brain. And then you realize that this all functioned on the backs of slaves. And so there were many layers, and the subject of food and politics, it's an umbrella that covers many different subjects, everything from the president's personal tastes to local politics, global diplomacy, climate change, war, religion, gender, and so on. The hard thing for me was to decide what not to use, because as I began to research this, I realized that every president has an interesting food story. And so I had to winnow it down, left a lot on the cutting room floor, hoped to return to some of it at some point, but really had a ball putting it together. And then halfway through it, COVID hit, and I wasn't able to go to these places any longer. But I had the great fortune of meeting people at the Smithsonian and at the Library of Congress and at some of the presidential libraries who helped me out while we were all twiddling our thumbs during the pandemic. So eventually the book came out. It was delayed a year by COVID because we literally couldn't produce the book. I'm not the only one who had that problem. But here we are, and I'm really happy to get out and talk about it.
So you say that it covers many subjects, but did you find that certain themes came through pretty clearly through your research?
Yes. Of course, one's own biases come through, but I was fascinated by the role of enslaved people in the White House kitchen and in the development of American cuisine as we know it today. I try to highlight the role of first ladies and first families where appropriate. Turns out that first ladies are not only important for the domestic sphere of the White House, but also politically. Some women really enjoyed the role, like Dolly Madison or Jackie Kennedy, although she had kind of mixed feelings, or Nancy Reagan. Others really didn't like it. Bess Truman hated being first lady and would go back to Missouri every chance she got. I thought that was interesting. And the way that personal dynamics within the first family can affect a much broader sphere. I won't say it affected the world, but it could affect the administration for better and for worse. The role of indigenous people, the role of different cuisines coming together to form what we now think of as American cookery. In the early days, our cooking was reliant on basically English recipes from books that were brought over. But those were combined with indigenous ingredients like venison and corn and wild turkey, ultimately tomatoes, the spices and herbs from some of the slave cooks, the tools and techniques of the French, in this wonderful amalgam of cookery. One of the people that really began to codify all this was Thomas Jefferson's slave, James Hemings, who Jefferson brought to Paris when he was an 18-year-old boy, trained him in some of Paris's finest kitchens, brought him back to the States, and used him as a political tool, essentially. Hemings cooked for George Washington and Hamilton and Adams and leading politicians of the day, and of course diplomats who came over for dinner. He was a wonderful intuitive cook. He cooked over open fire, which is difficult, and he had real technique. And his story is kind of fascinating to me. So, there's all of these little strands. I love the way that Jackie Kennedy, for example, based her entertaining on that of King Louis XIV of France, who was known as the Sun King, and very intentionally used delicious food and wonderful entertainment as a way of brokering diplomatic deals or business deals or even marriages. It was a way of keeping his friends close and his enemies closer. And Jackie used this probably better than any other first lady, and was emulated by Nancy Reagan to a certain degree of success. And it's fascinating to me how certain administrations understand the value of food as a political tool and others don't. And we can talk about that.
Sure. In fact, you had to choose among the presidents and pick 26, and we have just an hour with you. So we're going to do a brief survey through the centuries of individual presidents. And I do want to start with Thomas Jefferson, because you dub him our founding epicure. And you write, he set a new standard for the quality of food, wine, and conversation that has rarely, if ever, been matched. How so?
Well, Jefferson was a born epicure. He was raised with a high level of food in Virginia. He was a very inquisitive man. He was sent to France as an ambassador right before the French Revolution. While in France, he spent time at the royal court and saw how they used food as a political tool. But he also saw the starving communards who eventually revolted and began to guillotine the aristocracy there. He spent a lot of time tasting what were to him new foods and wines. He became a real enophile, wine expert. And he had, as I mentioned, James Hemings, his cook, who learned how to make things like vanilla ice cream or macaroni. And Jefferson traveled all over Europe, ostensibly doing diplomacy, but really collecting recipes and even foodstuffs. He discovered some wonderful Italian rice that he loved. And it was so prized that the Italians threatened to arrest him if he took any home. He disregarded that and filled his pockets with rice. And then he later hired I think basically some smugglers to bring some rice back over to America, where he planted it at Monticello. So he was a real foodie who appreciated food as a political tool, but also appreciated it aesthetically. And his favorite thing to do was to have a dinner party that began early, involved multiple courses, scintillating conversation, with people that he agreed and disagreed with, lots to drink, and talking late into the night. And some of his staff got weary of waiting for them to finish up so that they could go home at the end of the evening. But he's the kind of guy that I would have loved to hung out with. And he was very wise about using food to broker deals.
We can have a video that explains some of the inventions he had in his dining room. We're going to watch this. It's just a minute long.
In the Monticello dining room, there are a number of contraptions and conveniences that would limit the number of enslaved people that would be required to be present for the dinners. So the food would come in through a side door with revolving shelves, so that the enslaved waiters bringing the food from the kitchen underneath the house would not have to be entering the room and exiting the room nonstop. They could put the food on the door outside the room, and the enslaved butler, Burl Colbert, could simply turn the door and bring the food into the room. The wine cellar was located directly beneath the dining room, and on either side of the fireplace, Jefferson had built into the mantle wine dumbwaiters, so that the wine could be delivered straight up through the sides of the fireplace. So he's using these contraptions to limit the coming and going of enslaved servants, but at the same time, there's a lot of work going on behind the scenes by those enslaved servants to make that dinner and the engaging conversation taking place possible.
Alex Prudhomme, you write that he brought some of these techniques to the White House, and one of his goals was not to have loose lips reporting on the conversations that were going on in these dining rooms.
Yeah, that's right. He understood that breaking bread together was an opportunity for people to talk outside of the normal political channels. So he would invite people over who disagreed with each other vehemently in public, and they would break bread together in private and work out their differences, or at least agree to disagree and to work around it and create some legislation that more or less satisfied everyone. And he didn't want the slaves or anyone else listening in and misconstruing what was being said or leaking what was being said because it was so sensitive and private. And these, you know, so-called backroom deals really were effective. And in fact, in the musical Hamilton, Lin-Manuel Miranda has a whole rap. The song is called The Room Where It Happened. And that was in reference to a famous dinner which took place before Jefferson was president, when he brokered a deal between Madison and Hamilton to essentially save the Union, this young nation that we had, which was really an idea more than a functioning democracy. George Washington was president, and the warring factions were essentially North and South, and North being represented by Hamilton, the South by Madison. And the issues were how to structure the debt after the revolution and essentially create a financial system using taxation, and also where to build a federal city, which ultimately became Washington, D.C. And the public dialogue had gotten so poisonous that it was sort of beyond the point of repair. And so Jefferson was concerned that the young nation would fall apart. And so he invited Hamilton and Madison over for dinner, and they broke bread. And at first they wouldn't talk to each other, but eventually the wine and the delicious food made by James Hemings softened them. And they began to actually talk frankly, and they hashed out a deal, which became known as the dinner table bargain. And that deal, you know, arguably saved the Republic at that point. And so this is a way that Jefferson used food in a political way.
As one last question on Jefferson as president, because it also illustrates how he used food to gain information. You write this story that starting in 1801, he worked with his daughters Patsy and Polly to host three congressional dinners a week and kept notes of every legislator who attended. How did he use that information?
Isn't that great? You know, he affected this kind of carefree air, but underneath it all, he was very calculating, and he would invite people from different parties, the Federalists on one side and the Democratic Republicans on the other, and would essentially use these dinners to gather intelligence and figure out what they were really after, where deals could be made, where deals could not be made, to kind of keep a finger on the pulse of Washington, which at that time was a small backwater city, still very much under construction and formation. And he understood that a lot of these congressmen came from far away. They were often alone. They either didn't have families or couldn't bring their families. They were living in these boarding houses. They were kind of from very different backgrounds. And so it was kind of a stroke of genius to bring them together over something to eat and drink, make them feel comfortable, make them feel heard, and to then extract information from them, let them know where he stood on things. And it was really effective.
I'm going to fast forward 80 plus years to Ulysses S. Grant.
Yes.
What interested me in this chapter is that he came into office as a meat and potatoes military man. And you write of him that the evolution of the Grant's palates mirrored that of the American public, which became wealthier and more sophisticated after the Civil War. Tell me more about that.
Well, Grant was famously a military man. You may recall that he was also an alcoholic, which was the demon that stood on his shoulder his entire life, and he really fought against it. Before the Civil War, his alcoholism was noticed by his commanding officers, and he was cashiered. He ended up selling wood, firewood, on the corner of the street. He had a family, and it was a really down in the dumps. And then the Civil War, ironically, resurrected him, and he proved himself to be what they called unconditional surrender Grant on the battlefield, and eventually became the head of the U.S. Army, and then was elected president. And he As you said, was a meat and potatoes guy to begin with. He liked to have Army stewards prepare, you know, giant slabs of roast beef and mashed potatoes and turkey and more turkey and some cheese and apple pie. His wife wasn't thrilled with that. She aspired to be more like the Washington swells that she saw going by her window on their way to lovely dinners and lunches. So she redid her wardrobe. She redid the White House, and then she redid the kitchen and brought in a series of chefs. But the best known was a guy named Valentino Mela, who was born in Sicily, was an orphan, eventually came over to this country, was a wonderful cook. He was known as the professor because not only was he technically a genius, but he was sort of authoritative when he talked about food. And he would produce these, you know, 30 odd course dinners that were, you know, each one more fabulous than the last and paired with wine. After a few years of this, U.S. Grant, the old military guy, came to really appreciate good food. When he was in the Army, he would have a breakfast of coffee and cucumbers, which doesn't sound very appetizing. But eventually got into having kippered herring and bacon and eggs and lots of coffee. And you can see where this is going, which is that ultimately he embraced great cuisine and in fact hosted the first ever state dinner for a foreign dignitary. And that was King Kalakaua of the Sandwich Islands, which we now call Hawaii. And this is important for many reasons, but again, with back to the politics of food and the food of politics, the reason that King Kalakaua was in Washington was that he was trying to lower American tariffs on Hawaiian sugar. And they did work out a deal for that. And sugar became Hawaii's biggest export for many years, 100 years. But it also ultimately let the white sugar plantation owners take over and basically the capture of Hawaii as an American state many years later. But it was the first time that a state dinner had been hosted for a foreign dignitary, and it was a big deal. Mela created this amazing menu, which no longer survives, but we can infer that it was fabulous and had many courses. And that got a lot of attention in the press. And it was a moment when America was booming. You know, there were gold and timber coming from the West Coast, salmon, railroads were being built, factories were being built. It was kind of the mad rush financially and politically. And U.S. Grant got himself in some trouble. Some of his people in his administration were corrupt. He was a very trusting man, probably just intuitively, but also from his military career. Other people took advantage of him. And he used these dinners a little bit like Jefferson to bring people together, broker deals. But he didn't like getting all dressed up and being fancy. He liked kind of keeping things simple. And one of my favorite anecdotes is that he began to shoot bread balls at his children at the dinner table. And they thought that was hilarious. And he would sometimes forget where he was. And he shot a bread ball at the British ambassador's wife once, hit her in the head. And I think she was a little startled by that. But yeah, terrific, colorful character.
Moving into the 20th century and someone who liked being formal in a way that Grant did not, Herbert Hoover. Here's an interesting anecdote you write, is that he dressed in formal wear and ate a 7-course meal even when dining alone.
Yeah. And he was also, he would rush through his meals. He you know, he had these wonderful dinners, but he would rush through them.
He became known to the world because of his work basically as America's food czar and relief after the First World War. And tell me about his philosophy about food when he came into office.
Well, he understood that food was a political tool and rather intentionally used it to break the back of the rise of Bolshevism in Europe And, you know, the Russians, millions of Russians were starving, and he helped supply them with food. But he really made his mark during the First World War. After the Germans had invaded Belgium and France, they would steal the local food, and food riots would erupt. People were starving. And so Hoover and Wilson, who was president at the time, began to ship food and materiel across the Atlantic. And this was one of the things that led us into the war. And it was very, very effective. There were posters out that said, "Food will win the war." There's a whole fascinating history about that, about sort of the propaganda around food and how that could be used to political ends. And that was some of the stuff that I had to cut that I really personally enjoyed. But if anybody's interested, there's plenty out there of research to do. And, you know, ultimately, it led to global food programs that still exist today, where we are helping. We are the preeminent food donor around the world. Even now, people don't really realize this. But food is essential for life, obviously. We all need to eat. And it can be used for good and for ill. Someone like Churchill or even Hitler or Stalin would use food as a weapon. If you can capture your enemy's food and use it to feed your own people, you are also denying it from your enemy. And Churchill used to say that the stomach governs the world. And he used that in a very Manichaean, harsh way, even though he himself was a great gourmet.
Reminiscent of Jefferson, before the stock market crash changed everything, you say that he hired three full-time secretaries to build interesting guest lists for meals at the White House and insisted on serving the best foods. So insistent on this that the Hoovers only dined alone once a year on their anniversaries. How did he use these meals?
Again, much like Jefferson, that he would bring people together, pick their brains, let them know where he stood on issues. And, you know, the table is a place where people can let their guard down and they can speak off the record and they can be frank. And he valued that. Before he became president, he was a very successful global mining executive. He'd lived all over the world and had all sorts of adventures. He understood the value of breaking bread in a way that others didn't. But, you know, ironically, he had to contend with depression when people were starving. And in the beginning of that, he had a bit of a tin ear. He didn't realize that his fabulous meals at the White House weren't playing well politically while people were starving on the streets. And people building Hoovervilles, so-called. It became an ironic appetite that he had, that although he enjoyed good food, it ultimately worked against him, and people begin to throw rotten tomatoes and cauliflower at him. It was a sort of a sad ending to his administration.
Franklin Roosevelt is the person that you dubbed the second epicure in the White House. But when you read his chapters, you see that there was a big tug of war going on between him and Eleanor Roosevelt about White House food. What was that all about?
Well, this is where the side of the White House that people aren't always aware of comes to play, which is the domestic side. The relationship between Eleanor and FDR was fraught. They had been brought up in a wealthy milieu. They were actually distant cousins, and they were both cousins with Teddy Roosevelt. They were both brought up on delicious food with cooks in the house and servants. But they had a very contrasting style. FDR was a real gourmet, and a gourmet is somebody who loves delicious food, and a gourmand is somebody who eats to excess. So Teddy Roosevelt was a gourmand, but FDR was a gourmet. Eleanor treated food as fuel. Her children would complain that she would just eat toast and a thin soup and didn't really notice what she was eating. FDR loved exotic foods, you know, whether it was bison steaks or special fish flown in just for him from all over the place. And so that was a sort of guaranteed to cause some marital tension. They had such different views of food. Eleanor began to embrace feminism and a sort of domestic politics while FDR was contending with the Nazis' rise in Europe. And so she began to use the White House as a bully pulpit to promote healthy but economical eating. And in doing so, she hired a woman named Mrs. Henrietta Nesbitt, who she had met in Hyde Park over bread. Henrietta Nesbitt was a wonderful baker and began to supply FDR's political campaign with baked goods. And when they went to the White House, the Roosevelts hired the Nesbitts to come and work for them. The problem was that Henrietta Nesbitt had no idea about food, really, and no idea about supplying the White House, which was a very active place with lots of people under a bright spotlight. She didn't do the cooking. She was hired as the housekeeper, but she was in charge of the kitchen and the procurement of food. When rationing came on, she began to use leftovers and serve just horrible dishes like spaghetti with boiled carrots on top, or a so-called salad made of Jell-O with marshmallows in it, or crushed candy canes. And so for FDR, this was kind of a torture. She would also serve things like liver and beans 5 or 6 days in a row, or oatmeal, you know, 2 weeks in a row for breakfast every day. And he rebelled and would yell and scream, but he never fired her, which I thought was curious. He was the president of the United States and he couldn't control his own diet. So I looked into this and it turns out that Eleanor was protecting Mrs. Nesbitt. I think in part because when FDR was Secretary of the Navy, Eleanor discovered he was having an affair with her former social secretary, Lucy Mercer, which she saw as a real betrayal and was deeply wounded by this. It turned out that FDR most likely had other affairs. And so some historians have concluded that Eleanor used Mrs. Nesbitt as a weapon of domestic revenge, forcing FDR to eat horrible food to pay penance for his peccadilloes. In fact, Ernest Hemingway and his wife, Martha Gellhorn, visited the White House, and Hemingway has a hilarious description of what he called the worst meal he'd ever eaten. You know, a limp bit of squab and some old salad and a terrible cake that some unskilled amateur had made. And he said that that Gellhorn would go back to the White House, but he would never go back again.
We have about 25 minutes left in our conversation. We're learning about presidential food and the intersection of politics and presidential eating. And before we leave Roosevelt, I just wanted to get one not domestic, but diplomacy story in. And this is another clip that we have from Kevin Oldenburg, who is the site ranger at Top Cottage. And this is the story of the hot dog picnic.
Some of the guests included Madame Chiang Kai-shek of China, King George II of Greece, Crown Princess Marta of Norway, Queen Wilhelmina and Princess Juliana of the Netherlands, Mackenzie King, Prime Minister of Canada, King George VI, and Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mum from Great Britain. Winston Churchill was on this porch 4 different times. Probably the one most people are familiar with is the infamous hot dog picnic, the weekend that the King and Queen of England arrived here in Hyde Park. The visit was a very historic visit, as it was the first time that a seated British monarch had been to the United States. And that visit was capped off with a picnic on the porch here at Top Cottage. Now, we always hear about the hot dogs that were served, but the menu was much more vast than that. They had Virginia ham, smoked turkey, hot sausages, hot dogs, mixed green salad, strawberry shortcake for dessert. But it was the hot dogs that really stole the show, and they were Swift Premium hot dogs. and I don't believe the Queen had ever seen a hot dog before.
Alex Prudhomme, anything else on that story?
Well, he forgot to mention the beer, too. Hot dogs and beer. And, you know, the New York Times was so impressed. They had a big headline saying, King George eats hot dogs and drinks beer and asks for seconds. and this, again, there's a political motive here. This was before the U.S. entered the Second World War. FDR strongly feared Hitler and wanted to join the Allies against Germany. But the U.S. was in an isolationist mood at that point. Many Americans were still annoyed with Great Britain for not repaying their First World War debts. But he realized that the king and queen were a unique couple, and that he could, if he could humanize them and make them appealing to the American public, it might help to sway the public mood. And so this was a kind of a coup de théâtre, as the French say. It's a theatrical moment that he orchestrated. Much like Jefferson, FDR was a gastronome who understood how to use food in a very shrewd political way. And he knew that giving the king and queen hot dogs and beer at a quote unquote simple picnic would cause a sensation and create headlines. And sure enough, it did. At the same time, behind the scenes, he and King George conferred, and he quietly told the king that America has Britain's back and would start to send foods across the Atlantic in convoys and would sink any U-boats that attempted to attack them and let the chips fall where they may, which was quite a bold move at that point. And it didn't come a moment too soon because shortly after that, the Germans blitzkrieged into Poland and the Second World War was off and running. And by that point, he had helped to convince the American public that indeed we should support the Allies in Europe. And that picnic became known as the picnic that won the war. And I love that story.
So if FDR used Top Cottage as his place to bring people into the fold, Dwight Eisenhower had the farm in Gettysburg where he did much the same thing. And then there's LBJ and his ranch in West Texas, visited it 74 times in the 5 years that he was in office. And you say he was a practitioner of barbecue diplomacy. How did
That's
it work?
Right. Well, he had a formula down, which is quite impressive that, you know, there's this great myth of the American cowboy in the West, and he used that very shrewdly. He would get people out of Washington or out of their embassies, and he would fly them out to his ranch in Texas, in the Texas Panhandle. And the formula worked like this. You would show up at the ranch, and he would take you on a leisurely horseback ride around the ranch and show you this and that. And then he'd give you a beer to quench your thirst. Then you'd have a dinner of barbecued ribs or perhaps some pedernales chili, which was created by his black cook, Zephyr Wright. It was a wonderful dish. A big, thick piece of cake, some cornbread, more beer, maybe a little bourbon or whiskey of some kind. And then he'd move in. He'd say, now, I'd like you to do me a favor. And whether that was a congressman or Konrad Adenauer of Germany or whoever was visiting, this was a very effective tool because few people could resist his charm, the ranch, and the food and drink.
But at the same time, does he not also hold the record for the most state dinners, 55?
Yeah.
What does that say? He was also using the White House as a tool.
Exactly right. Yeah. He understood it. He was a man who was very observant. He had a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. He kind of came from the wrong side of the tracks. He had grown up, near starvation. His family occasionally ran out of food and they would have to borrow meals essentially from neighbors or ask for handouts. And so food for him was a loaded subject. And once he was in a position to create food legislation programs to help the poor get food, they were very personal efforts by him. Again, I mentioned Zephyr Wright, his personal cook. She helped to persuade him to write the Civil Rights Act. And after he signed it, he gave her the pen. So food for him was a potent metaphor and message, and he understood its power in a very visceral way that many presidents don't.
One point we have not gotten on the table is how is all this paid for, this entertaining by presidents?
Well, that's a good question, and it's still confusing today. The tradition is that official dinners, state dinners in particular, which can be very expensive, you know, sometimes millions of dollars, and take months and months of planning, those are paid for by the U.S. government. However, the president and the first family are essentially employees of the government, and they have to pay their own way. They have to buy their own food, their own clothes, their own toiletries, whatever. And so this has been a sticking point for some presidents who don't come from means. People like Harry Truman, for example, who was a haberdasher in Missouri and did not have great fortune behind him. But if you were someone like JFK, he had his father's vast fortune to rely on. Or if you were someone like Jefferson, who had a slave plantation, you had plenty of money to entertain in a style, in a high style. And so, you know, it's a point of contention.
So let's fast forward to the 1980s and Ronald Reagan. A statistic in your book, 75,761 people dined at the White House during the first Reagan term. What was he using all those meals for?
Well, Nancy Reagan modeled her entertaining on Jackie Kennedy. She claimed she didn't, but very clearly she did. And was actually quite effective in reaching across the aisle and brokering deals. You may remember that the Reagan years were politically tense, but behind the scenes, Nancy managed to orchestrate various dinners with the so-called opposition, Democrats who held sway in Washington at the time, even going into so-called enemy territory, going into the Graham household, who the people who ran the Washington Post, or into private clubs. But Nancy also understood the value of pomp and circumstance. And so one of the first big events that they did at the Reagan White House was a celebration of Reagan's birthday. And that was a black tie affair, very fancy. But this was considered a private party that their wealthy friends helped to pay for. There's less press scrutiny. It's all kind of off the record. And the private parties tend to be a lot more fun, a little looser. They aren't constricted by protocol. It's basically their personal friends, their donors, their political allies coming over. You know, Reagan used food, interestingly, to connect with his base. He's famous for his jelly beans. The jelly beans are an interesting story because they appear to be just kind of a sweet, trivial candy. But actually, the backstory is that he started eating jelly beans because he was weaning himself off of tobacco. He was a pipe smoker. And then he used jelly beans to judge people's character. If someone came into his office and began to pick out certain colored jeans and not beans and not eat them, he took note of that. It meant something about that person to him. And it was also a way of using food to relate to his voters. He would say, well, you know, I like this simple sweet candy. You like it. Therefore, vote for me. In fact, he didn't actually even have to say that. He just used the jelly beans as a metaphor for his good-natured, folksy demeanor. He would hold up a big jar of jelly beans and show it to the cameras and smile. It did backfire at one point when there was sort of a coming together of events where he was eating jelly beans, which are a sugary candy. His administration declared infamously ketchup to be a vegetable. And at the same moment, Nancy Reagan had just acquired a very expensive, large, and rather beautiful set of new White House china, which, by the way, was paid for by private funds, by donors. But what got lost in the hoo-ha that happened was that Reagan cut back school lunch expenditures at the very same time that Nancy was buying china, and that he was calling ketchup a vegetable, and it blew up in his face. That's the downside. If you're a president, every bite you take matters. And that was an example where a seemingly simple situation spun out of control.
He was just shy of LBJ's 55 state dinners. Two of them you write about. One became emblematic of the 1980s, Charles and Diana arriving at the White House. But his most significant was his state dinner with Mikhail Gorbachev. Why?
Well, this was essentially the curtains being drawn over the Cold War. Gorbachev had realized that the ongoing Cold War was destroying Russia and Europe, and Reagan, with Maggie Thatcher, was forcing his hand. And so after years of negotiations and dinners in Europe and all over the place, Gorbachevs came to Washington and were hosted by the Reagans at a wonderful state dinner. It was a very emotional moment, and people in the audience were crying because the moment was a historically significant dinner. But you mentioned the Lady Diana Prince Charles visit. That was a bit of theatrics orchestrated by Nancy Reagan, a la Jackie Kennedy, where this was ostensibly a surprise that Ronald Reagan was dancing with Lady Di, Nancy was dancing with Prince Charles, and then in a signal from Nancy, out of the shadows stepped John Travolta, this sinuous dancer from Saturday Night Fever, who Lady Di had wanted to meet. And they had a very sexy dance together. And it was one of those images that defined the Reagan White House. It was a fabulous moment of food, entertaining, a combination of celebrity and royals. To a certain extent, the nation's mind was being blown seeing this. And it was the images of that night went around the world and still to this day are defining of that era. So even though Reagan was not a particularly foodie person, Nancy understood the value of food and entertaining and used it quite effectively.
Alex Putin, we have 10 minutes left, and I'm going to do a quick romp through the 21st century's presidents. You write of so far the 20th century has been a confusing time in the food of politics and the politics of food. So let me go through the four 21st century presidents real quickly, and I have one line from each for you to comment on.
Sure.
George W. Bush, how 9/11 changed presidential food really forever. What were the changes after 9/11?
Well, in personal terms, the president could no longer accept food gifts from all across the country, which was a popular thing because we became so concerned about security. That really changed things. And the clampdown also returned us to simpler, more homey food, comfort food, because we were in a state of trauma, and it sort of realigned priorities.
Barack Obama, the most globally informed palate since Herbert Hoover. And you also write, during his administration, food became part of a larger culture war.
Well, Obama, when he was campaigning, was criticized for being an elitist because he liked to eat arugula salad. He was a real foodie. And Michelle Obama was someone more focused on health. Her Let's Move campaign was very popular and helped people start thinking about obesity and diabetes, which can lead to all sorts of horrible diseases. They used food in quite a shrewd way. The problem was that Barack Obama tried to emulate Teddy Roosevelt and bust up some of the big food trusts and failed. The lobbyists and the food companies made sure that that didn't work out. And ultimately, Michelle Obama became more effective by planting her White House garden, which I think is a terrific story, partly because it seemed radical at the time to rip up this beautiful green lawn at the White House and plant a vegetable garden. But it was also very retro. The early years of the White House, presidents often had gardens there, or chickens running around, or even a few of them had cows, some of whom lived in the White House for their milk. And so it was a return to tradition. It was not only a message about healthy eating, it was also a message about the politics of food. And Michelle understood that and was a little tentative about jumping into that battle, but ultimately did. And that proved more effective in getting the message out than the president's legislation.
Of Donald Trump, you write, he understood the politics of the dinner table better than any other president since the Kennedys.
Yeah, people can't believe it when I say that, but it's true. He used food in a very shrewd way. I'm not sure how well thought out it was. He liked to say that he operated from his gut, literally and metaphorically. And so when he would tweet pictures of his taco bowl or his Pizza Hut or his McBurgers, this directly appealed to his base. I talked to some academics about this. When you see someone wearing a similar shirt to you, you think, oh, that's a nice shirt, but it doesn't really register too much. But if you see somebody eating the same kind of food that you like, it triggers something in our primal brain. It almost goes back to our prehistory, where food was a matter of life and death on a daily basis. And so if you saw somebody eating the same kind of food you did, that essentially meant you were of the same tribe. And it's true today. And it's not a conscious thought we have. It's an emotional impulse. So much like Reagan and his jelly beans, Trump was saying, you like the same kind of food that I do, therefore vote for me. Again, he didn't have to say that. It was just the message of those images. And like Reagan, when he hosted the Clemson football team for a so-called burger banquet in the state dining room under the portrait of Abe Lincoln at the White House, the images of that dinner went around the world instantly and became defining ones. And people, traditionalists on both sides of the aisle, were outraged by this. And that was the point. He made a statement visually about his values and his voters. And it was reminiscent of Andrew Jackson and other populists who very intentionally used symbols like that to appeal to his voters. And it was extremely effective.
Joe Biden came into office still with the COVID restrictions. He's had one state dinner. Any observations about Joe Biden's relationship with food?
Well, Joe is a spaghetti and ice cream eating guy. He's not a great sophisticate on food, but his wife, Jill, is a very accomplished cook. She grew up with Italian grandparents who liked to make homemade pastas and bracioli and meatballs and homemade bread. And she took up the mantle of cookery in their household. Actually, Kamala Harris is a very accomplished cook and, in fact, has some cooking videos you can see online where she's brining a turkey, or she's schooling Senator Warner on making a tuna melt, or she's making a masala dosa with Mindy Kaling. And she, her interest in food is very genuine too. And so it's interesting. This, again, is the role of the First Lady, where there's a blending of the personal and the political when it comes to food.
Well, on that note, excuse me, you closed with some observations about the role of the president and the first family as eaters in chief. What are your thoughts about that, and what opportunities and responsibilities the role comes with?
Well, the public really pays attention to what the president and first family eat. There are studies done on this. And so when Trump was talking about his burgers, the consumption of fast food, particularly amongst Republicans, went up. And it sort of gives people license to eat what the president eats. The president is reflecting the nation's taste, but he's also got his own taste. Looking back, there are foods like possum or squirrel stew or turtle soup that past presidents have eaten that were very trendy in their day that we considered weird or even disgusting now. But when they would eat those things, the presidents inspired the public. And so my feeling is that the president ought to acknowledge this more openly and promote the best of American food, the best of American cooking ingredients, techniques. I think we ought to showcase the White House kitchen and cooks. The kitchen, the executive kitchen, is in, on the ground floor. It's kind of a very small space hidden away. I think we ought to physically and metaphorically elevate the kitchen, bring it upstairs, put it in the sunlight, allow the public to have a peek at it from a safe distance, and see these wonderful meals being made there by these very accomplished cooks that are feeding the president and first family on a daily basis, but also congressmen and dignitaries from abroad, and really elevate the role of the White House kitchen and the White House cooks.
We have 2 minutes left. Do you want to tell the story of your state dinner that you hosted?
Well, this was a really fun thing. I managed to get in right before COVID started, luckily enough. I had been trying to get invited to a state dinner while working on this book. The Trump administration only held two of them and didn't see fit to invite me because I wanted to do what Julia Child had done way back, which was to cover a state dinner, show the American public a side of the White House that they don't normally see. I was denied that opportunity. And so I got creative and I decided to create my own state dinner. Through hook and by crook, I managed to convince a former White House cook, John Mueller, to cook a wonderful dinner. Each of the courses was based on a real recipe used at the White House for a state dinner and has a story behind it. We started with mushroom soup, moved on to a delicious salmon, a salad with Amish cheese, and finished with a chocolate bomb that was fabulous. And I invited 10 people who had either worked at the White House or covered it for the Washington Post or were food historians. And we had a lively conversation about what it's like to be at a state dinner and why it's still important and still relevant, even in this era of the internet. And how human connection over food is this seemingly hardwired into us humans. We just seem to need to eat together, whether we like each other or not. And it's a great way of brokering dialogue and moving things forward.
Alex Prudhomme's book also has just a few historic presidential recipes included for your readers. The book is titled Dinner with the President, Food, Politics, and a History of Breaking Bread at the White House. Thanks so much for spending an hour with us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much. And let's all break bread together.
Thanks for listening to C-SPAN's Q&A. And subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts so you'll never miss an episode. And while you're there, please take a minute to rate and review us. You can also send us an email about Q&A at podcasts@c-span.org. Send me your questions, your comments, or ideas. Your feedback is welcome.